And by the same token, I mean, we list in the book how little so many countries that matter in the world are spending on the race for AI supremacy. I mean, Australia, not to pick on Australia, because I love Australia, but they've only just started to think about this stuff, and they've thrown, you know, $1 million or $2 million at it over the successive years.
Wow.
And many, many countries don't even have or just recently got some sort of a policy on AI going forward, and are only starting to throw some money at it. I mean, I don't know why that could possibly be the case. Why would they think that this doesn't matter in this day and age?
That's Daniel Wagner, who joins me with Keith First to talk about AI supremacy, up next on the All Things Risk podcast. We are back with another episode of the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome or welcome back. My name is Ben Cattaneo, your host. If you're new here, I do long-form conversations with some fascinating guests. I use the lenses of risk and uncertainty to cover some of the biggest and most interesting risks and uncertainties of our times, as well as hearing from many of my great guests about examples of inspirational, effective, entertaining, and practical risk-taking. As I say around here, risk is life. Now, our last few episodes and this one that you're listening to now have been and are is about books. And one of the great recent innovations, relatively recent innovations in books, are audiobooks that you can listen to on your phone with Audible. See what I did there? If you are a listener to the All Things Risk podcast, you can get a free 30-day trial, an audiobook which is yours to keep no matter what. You can choose from over 180,000 titles. Simply go to audibletrial.com/allthingsrisk if you are in the USA. If you are in the UK, click on the link accompanying this post, which you can find on allthingsrisk.co.uk. So with that out of the way, let's get into the episode. Today, we have Daniel Wagner and Keith First on the show. We are talking about artificial intelligence. And if you are a longtime listener, those names should be familiar because I've had Daniel now, I think, four times previously on the show and Keith once before. Daniel is an expert in risk and in country risk, and I've had him on to discuss his previous books, Virtual Terror and Risk Agility. He's also been on talking about country risk, all topics of things that he's written, including books and articles. Daniel is the CEO and founder of Country Risk Solutions. Keith is an expert in financial crime and fraud. He runs a firm called Data Derivatives. I've had him on talking about all things, including crypto and philosophy and loads of other very interesting stuff. But the two have recently teamed up to write a book called AI Supremacy, Winning in the Era of Machine Learning. This is a book that provides a much needed fresh perspective on artificial intelligence, and it makes the conversation about AI accessible to people beyond just the techies. And it's a conversation that we desperately need, and I am delighted to be able to start to bring that conversation to you. You know, there isn't nearly as much coverage of AI than there should be. And what we do hear about seems to fall into two, maybe three camps. One is you get the articles and the pieces from the likes of the World Economic Forum, the big four accountancy firms, prominent consultancies that talk about all the wonderful things that AI and machine learning will bring. And it's true, there are many benefits to these technologies. On the other hand, the second type of stuff that we hear are the technical stuff about the ins and outs of the technology. And I suppose the third camp are conspiracy theories. And the balance just isn't right. And on top of that, there are those who feign knowledge in the topic, and there just is a need for an honest, informed, and open view of the risk and opportunities of AI, and this is the gap that AI supremacy fills. We get into that and more, including what AI, machine learning, and neural networks are. We talk about the opportunities AI brings to many industries, including financial services, healthcare, manufacturing, law, many more. We get into AI and policing and the prospect of predictive policing. We talk about governance, privacy, and ethics. We even get into AI in sex and relationships. And just today, I came across an article with the headline, "Humans Could Be Marrying Robots by 2050. So you'll hear a little bit about that in this episode. But we then get into international relations and the race for AI supremacy. And you'll be blown away by what you hear about China, how much it's spending and what it's doing on AI and what that means, and why there's such a gap in AI funding in the US and the West. We get into what we should be doing, and Keith and Daniel share a number of other insights. It's a fantastic episode, a fantastic conversation. So let's get into it. Here is Daniel Wagner and Keith First talking about AI supremacy. So Keith, Daniel, welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. Pleasure to have you both on once again. I think, Daniel, this is the fourth or fifth time you've been on, and Keith, this is the second time. So great to have you both back.
I've lost count, to be honest, Ben, but it's great to be back.
So today,
good to be here, Ben.
Yeah, Keith, you know, this is one of the things we'll get into this, but one of the things I was thinking about as I was reading AI supremacy, and we're going to talk about AI, was how relevant philosophy is in all of this and what our consciousness is all about and all that. So we're going to get into some really cool stuff. And I just remembered your background in philosophy. So very, very relevant, I think, to what we're talking about, what you do. But before we get into any of that, I want to get from both of you. So this book, AI Supremacy, Winning in the Era of Machine Learning, where did the idea come from to embark on this journey of exploration into all things AI?
Well, yeah, I think what happened was I started writing something related to artificial intelligence, and I just had sort of like this itch to write. It wasn't completely artificial intelligence. I was focusing more on my area and financial crime and due diligence, and then AI was a big component of it. And there was a discussion that Daniel and I had at some point, and then I think it was he or I that proposed, hey, maybe we should write a few articles on AI. And at a certain point I was like, why don't we just write a book? And then that apparently seemed like a good idea, that, you know, once that ball started rolling, I mean, there was no stopping it. So it's really happened, something like that.
And from my side, Ben, you know, I had published Virtual Terror in 2017, and I thought I was going to take a pretty substantial break from book writing for a while. Mm. But it actually was Keith's idea, and he gave me a call in January of this year and said, would you be interested? And I thought, you know what? I actually would, because this is a very compelling topic. And I think Keith would agree. I think that the audience is going to benefit from having two individuals who are deep in the risk management arena thinking about this from outside the AI arena, meaning we're not practitioners in AI per se. So it's giving, I think, a really much needed and well-deserved fresh intellectual perspective on what this AI beast is all about.
In reading it, it's a fabulous overview of all of the key areas, and I think a number of the key risks and difficult questions. I'm not sure that we're thinking about all of these questions sufficiently. And just the other day, I was looking at an article from the World Economic Forum talking about AI and financial services and how it creates better opportunities to create better customer loyalty and solutions to shared problems and collaboration and a lot of great stuff, which is probably true. And similarly, There is some passing reference to some of the ethical dilemmas, but I'm not sure that the balance is right in that when we hear think about or get these great, you know, these great concepts coming to us from the likes of an Amazon or a Google or whatever around, you know, the future is quite rosy, etc. But there are some risks, and we'll get into that. But before we do, I wanted to get from both of you let's just talk about what is AI? What does it mean? What is the definition that you guys are using?
Go ahead, Keith.
Okay, I'll give a stab at it. I mean, for me, artificial intelligence, I have a very, it's a blanket term. It's very wide in its use, and partly it's due to the fact that when we think of, I mean, it has a historical reference of when it was used in the 50s and this sort of thing, and, you know, the traditional definition is sort of, you know, imitate cognitive abilities of humans, but I would even spread it a little wider and say if we think about intelligence, even a calculator, you know, you can say is artificial intelligence, right? Or, you know, if you want to go, you know, it's how you define intelligence. So to me, it is very much about, you know, replicating or trying to replicate the cognitive activity of humans in that sense. And also, but it is a blanket term, so it's very wide, like I said. And when you get into like the machine learning part, this is really where the hot area is, and you get into deep learning, this sort of thing, and it basically becomes a place where you can use data to find patterns and then predict things with, you know, remarkable accuracy. And basically anything can be represented in data, so nearly anything can be predicted. It doesn't take account for randomness, but that's sort of my wide definition of what AI is, at least to me.
And I see it in essence as a challenge to humanity in the sense that we have an opportunity to unleash our own potential through AI. The question ultimately becomes how, when that's going to be done, not a question of if, and the extent to which we're going to lose track of things like ethics and governance in the process. We're up to the task of meeting our own challenge in that regard from a technical perspective, but I think we're generally woefully unprepared to do that from these other perspectives, and that's a lot of what this book is about.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about deep learning, and you use the term a lot, machine learning and things like neural networks, and similarly, what do we mean when we're talking about those things?
So for deep learning, again, it's a blanket term and it's an evolved over, you know, time. But a simple definition is, you know, it's a neural network with two or more layers. So what they mean by that is sort of it's sort of a very complex decision tree, so to speak.
Right.
And by layers, they mean, you know, let's say you wanted to the classic examples, look at handwriting of letters or numbers. And then within the layers, you know, the first layer would identify, you know, maybe round edges. The second layer is like arcs. And then maybe the third is lines. And then slowly they can make the abstraction of the idea, okay, this is what the essence, not completely the essence, so this is what a nine looks like in all its various forms, or this is the letter, the capital H, or something like that. And then when you kind of understand, you know, apart from the technical of how they actually get there and, you know, they adjust the weights, the parameters, all that stuff. But it's essentially having higher levels of abstraction. And then you can do things like, you know, facial recognition or these other complex tasks, which really seem remarkable. But they're basically breaking down the problem into smaller pieces and then building it up on top and then coming to a higher abstraction, making that, you know, prediction or determination, whatever it is.
Right. So anyone who's done a simple decision tree, for example, I'll choose to do this or that, and then this might happen and then that might happen. That, you know, should I accept this job or accept that job or whatever, and you can kind of work out the nodes of a very simple decision tree. And what basically you're saying is this is for everything. So multiply that by a million times in terms of all the nodes of everything. And not only that, every time it does the decision tree and there's an outcome, it refines it to be able to make the prediction tool, the algorithm, more accurate.
Yeah. You're speaking about an aspect of it, which actually I believe Jeffrey Hinton came up with it, this idea of backpropagation, where it would make a prediction, and then if it was off by a certain amount, it would backpropagate, so the future mm-hmm. predictions would be more accurate. So that was one of the breakthroughs in in deep learning, and now how all this sort of remarkable things that we can do today, like facial recognition, is possible. So mm-hmm. that's a good point.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, the technology is getting there, obviously, and it creates all sorts of things. But one of the things that I found really interesting, fascinating fact, was your chapter on jobs in manufacturing. And you guys make a very relevant point that it's not necessarily the case that AI and machines and robots will displace everybody and jobs will go away, that new jobs will be created. And that's quite interesting.
Well, it's absolutely right. And it's only natural for people to be concerned about what impact this is going to have on both blue and white collar jobs, because it's going to affect everything. But the natural inclination is to presume that this is going to have a cumulatively negative impact on the job scene. And what we discuss in the book is that there have been numerous instances throughout history where, in fact, those technological leaps that everyone presumed would result in job losses mm-hmm. did not. For example, when we got to automatic teller machines in the latter half of the last century, everyone presumed it was going to put bank branches out of business. Well, we know very well that's not the case. What ended up happening was that the teller, the definition of what became the teller, changed, and tellers ended up selling financial products, mm-hmm. and it ended up expanding the number of bank branches. That's a very simple example of what we're talking about here. But I think it's also worth pointing out that nobody really knows what mm-hmm. the impact is going to be. What we can tell you is that throughout history, there have been numerous instances where the paradigms and the dynamics have changed to such a degree that they have become modified to accept the new normal. And that's what we presume is going to happen here.
Mm-hmm. The loads of jobs that exist now that didn't exist 5-10 years ago, right? 10 years ago, an app developer, what's that, right?
Well, that's exactly right. And the speed of change, technological change in particular, is so tremendous at this point in time that all of the predictions that are being made about when this is going to happen and when that's going to happen, they're being written almost on a constant basis. I mean, we presume, for example, that the U.S. is going to retain its leadership in this arena. And one of the things we discuss in the China chapter is that that's not going to be the case for very long. China, for example, is poised to take over the lead in the AI arena as soon as the next decade, and they're spending a ton of money and devoting a lot of resources to make sure that that happens.
Yeah, the other thing I would add to that, to Dan's comment, I agree to that. You also see very comprehensive planning from China, and I mean comprehensive down to the detail of the educational system actually introducing it as an AI literacy. So when they say they want to become leaders, they truly mean it, in the sense that it's getting into every nook and cranny of the economy, the society, the culture. And I think that's the way you're going to win. If you focus on one area of it, you don't become competent in all the other areas. So they're definitely on the road.
Can I just add to that, Ben? I'm sure you've got some additional questions you want to ask us even this early on in the broadcast, but I think it's important maybe at the outset to talk about what AI supremacy is, what we mean by that. And I think it's fair to say that this is a race, and you'll see on the cover of the book that we actually have robots running a race, and the robots represent both nations and industries. And it definitely is a race, but the idea of becoming supreme in this area, it's a point in time. There is no one nation, no one company, no one industry that's going to be supreme in AI for any great length of time, because it's always just going to be a question of time until some other country or company supplants whoever the leader of the moment is. So it's sort of a perpetual race, if you will. And that's what we mean by supremacy. It's an ongoing race.
Go for it, Keith. Were you going to
say there's other concepts. I totally agree with Daniel. There's other concepts in the book we explore with, you know, like government and things like that. And in that sense, they want to become supreme in the sense of becoming more efficient for their citizens so they can offer services and this sort of thing. So, there's a lot of ways to interpret it, but yeah, it's using the technology. It's becoming, the most proficient. And it raises other issues where this whole idea of monopolies is could become a real issue. I mean, you mentioned early on in the broadcast about financial services and then banks predicting what their customers want more often. But what that actually entails or what it leads to is that the biggest banks have the most data, so they make the better predictions. So they're going to win more and more customers. So slowly, the smaller businesses could kind of get phased out because they can't compete. They don't have the data. Right. So this is going to be a really interesting issue that comes up. How are governments going to deal with, you know, regulating these big banks? Like, what do you define as a monopoly? And right. AI could actually make this much more complicated.
Maybe we'll let you ask a couple of questions.
I think there's loads of very interesting stuff in all of that. I wanted to put a pin or a marker into something that we can talk about a bit later on when we get into geopolitics and this idea of a race and supremacy. And that is I see lots of dichotomies. I see yin and yang throughout all of this. And one of those is the need for collaboration amongst governments, as well as this, you know, aspect of hybrid warfare and competition. But I want to put a pin in that, because also in that, keeping along this theme of a dichotomy of a yin and yang, the individual, right? So in your chapter on manufacturing, you said, well, there will be jobs that will be created, and those jobs will actually revolve around the types of things that make us more human. So things that involve intuition, creativity, curiosity, those types of things. And I thought, well, that sounds great. That's really good. We'll have more interesting jobs. But later on in the book, you talk about how Amazon, for example, has a way of nudging and tracking people's productivity, right? And quite possibly a way of influencing its employees' neural pathways and what we're thinking potentially, and so that creates an interesting dichotomy, because on the one hand, you know, we might be using more of the things in our jobs that make us human, but on the other hand, more of those things might be influenced by those with a monopoly, as you say, Keith, and those that have an agenda. So I thought that was very interesting, and I just wanted to perhaps get some of your thoughts around all of that.
That is it's just a glimpse. You know, I think a lot of this book is that we're catching glimpses of what's to come. And to me, it's such a subtle thing. And, what's the problem? You have somebody in a factory and they wear a wristband, and you say, okay, let's pack this thing more efficiently. And then you sort of, we're just going to nudge you the right way. But then, when you start to look at the other developments that are happening, specifically in the healthcare space, there's a lot going on with mapping brain activity. They can even scan your brain and reconstruct an image fairly accurately. you know, looking at what type of neural activity, what it's representing. You know, so if they can nudge you the right way with a wristband, you know, what's to say that in the future, you know, the company's not going to read your mind and try to influence it? I mean, these things could be very far out, but, you know, if we don't begin to address them now and set boundaries of, you know, as a society, as a culture, what are we willing to give up? What's right? What's wrong? You know, what it means to be human? Then we could lose sight of this, and then, you know, this could all become the new normal. But is that a new normal that we want to live in? You know,
There's a lot of sub themes and sub contexts that are going on, as you've both pointed out. On one hand, our premise is that as AI develops further, it's going to encourage the best and the brightest to shine. And even those perhaps who weren't considered or didn't consider themselves to be the best and the brightest, it may encourage them to be more than they previously were or might be in the future as a result, because the nature of the competitive landscape is changing in the process. But vis-a-vis Amazon and nudging, I think in general, it's incumbent upon us to determine what the limitations are going to be for AI, because some people envision that there will at some point in time, and presumably not too far in the future, be this super intelligence wherein the robots are going to be smarter than we are, and they're not going to need to be supervised, and they're going to be totally autonomous, and we'll have this iRobot kind of future. A lot of this stuff that we consider to be the realm of science fiction is quickly becoming reality. And some experts believe that it won't be too long, maybe even just a couple of decades, before we're facing that kind of a reality, because of the pace of change and because of the absence of rules and governance and boundaries, if you will, similar to the cyber world. Where are the boundaries in AI? We're facing a lot of similar questions and dilemmas. And there is no single right answer to all this stuff, Ben. That's part of the challenge of writing this book. It's part of the joy of imagining the possible and what may happen next.
Right. It's about getting the right questions on the table, I think, which you think you do very, very well. When I was reading the chapter on health, one of the things that I did consider is this idea of predictive diagnoses, or more accurate diagnoses. And you could even, you talk about this, boiling it down to recommendations that you might get from your Amazon Echo or whatever around what, you know, vitamins and medication to take. And I thought, well, that's kind of cool. On the other hand, I thought, well, maybe not, because, so for example, my own self, heart disease runs in my family, and I try to counter that by taking good care of myself. But what if I get what if there's a prediction that moves me towards taking some heart medication, for example, when I get older, that I perhaps don't need, but there's an interest in selling me that medication, for example, as one example. And you talk about biases in some of these algorithms and whether or not they there's potentially a danger of those biases being built into some of the AI algorithms that will and are shaping our daily lives.
Yeah, no, I think you bring up a good point, but there's two parts to this. One is when you think about preventable disease, like trying to prevent something that happens, that I agree with you. You know, we got to be careful not to, you know, take medication for like, a restless leg syndrome, they call it. I mean, that's sort of, you know, maybe it does exist. It seems a bit much, but okay. But however, you know, I think the real value is AI, early detection of a problem that does exist in a disease or something like that. So not trying to prevent it by telling you the perfect formula of vitamins and, you know, meats that you should eat in the morning, but actually finding something early that could really make a difference. And not only that, but actually making the right diagnosis, which is a huge problem. I forget the percentage, but it's something like the number of deaths that happen in the U.S. I mean, it's for medical errors, it's astronomical, you know, and because, you know, medicine today is sort of like, you know, it's they're carving with a dull blade, you know, and AI is going to be that razor precision. Mm. So in that sense, I think AI in the healthcare field, if it's used properly, is a very positive thing, or could be.
We talk in the book in this chapter about things that have already occurred that have been astonishingly positive in the medical arena, freeing up doctors to not spend so much time having to, you know, plow through all this research to find an answer, for example.
Absolutely.
Making them far more productive. You could say that about the legal arena as well in the chapter on the law. It's just astronomical, the amount of research that can be plowed through in a matter of seconds. I mean, I think IBM Watson can do something like 1 billion pages of research in a minute. That it can plow. It's just mind-boggling what these new technologies can do. So at the end of the day, it seems to me that those organizations that have already invested substantially, such as IBM in Watson, and they've been doing this already now for pretty much more than a decade, and they've invested billions and billions of dollars in it. Those folks, they've got a lead, a very substantial lead that's not going to go away because everybody else is just falling further and further behind. So you've got maybe, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 companies in the world that have this truly substantial lead. Most of them are in China and the U.S. You probably know what the names are. I mean, it's Alibaba and Tencent and Baidu in China, and it's Facebook and Amazon and Google in the U.S. These companies, they're light years ahead of most of the competition. And as time goes on, the rest of them just fall further and further behind. So then it becomes a race for supremacy among these small handful of organizations as well as countries, right? There's only a few countries that are really in the lead, and those are represented on the cover.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And I guess the points around both doctors and lawyers, right? That if you're a practicing doctor or a lawyer, you don't have time to do significant amounts of research. So this cuts that down significantly and creates a huge amount of efficiency. But I guess the concern I had is if you have only the small number of players that are in the lead, how can we be confident in the lack of bias potentially in some of the conclusions that some of these technologies will create? And I know you talk about bias a lot in the book.
Yeah, well, one interesting thing that could develop in the medical field, I think we're starting to see it, and just, again, glimmers of what's happening. But the large hospitals, they actually could develop their own AI centers, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that the big hospitals are going to be willing all the time to give up their data to these companies. Because if you think about it, there was this eye center in the UK, I forget the name of it, but they gave, you know, 50,000 medical records and about eye scans to this DeepMind, which Google bought. Mm. But then there was a lot of concerns about the data being shared and this sort of thing. So we could have also industries that control the data, such as the medical field, which is worth a lot of money. They develop their own AI and then compete with the bigger companies. And the bigger companies could go after the smaller players, maybe the small hospitals that can't aggregate as much data. So we could have companies competing in the future that are really historically in totally different industries. So it could be interesting how this kind of plays out.
Right. Right. Okay. It's a very there's so much there. You talk about the world of international relations a fair bit as well, let's talk about one actor, and let's talk about China in a little bit more detail, because you've got a whole chapter on there, and where you, Daniel, you talked about China and the U.S. and where these two players are. Is it safe to say that those are the two main players in terms of nation states that that are leading the way here? Are there others? And if so, you know, what is China doing that the U.S. isn't doing? And I think that would be very interesting for my listeners to understand.
Yeah, so those are clearly the two leading state actors at the moment. But what is absolutely striking as well as shocking to us is how little in the way of resources and money and time is being spent on a national level in the U.S. Now, what's going on with the military, we cannot know, and clearly there's a big effort underway there, but they don't publicize that. But from the research that we've been able to gather, compare that, which is maybe just a few billion dollars a year on a government, on a non-military governmental level in the U.S., with the effort that's going on in China now, where they have this ambition to be the global leader in AI by 2030, which is, you know, just 10 plus years away. Mm-hmm. And they're spending, in terms of M&A and acquisitions and resources and talent, they're spending close to $150 billion to try to achieve this during that period. And they're being pretty ruthless about how they want to get to the top, as is pretty common in terms of what China wants. They sort of elbow their way and get to the front of the line. And, you know, sometimes rules apply and sometimes they don't. And that's just the way international relations works. I don't know that we can necessarily blame them for that. You want to get to the top of the pile, you got to get to the top of the pile. So I think my concern is that once they get that pile, will anybody be able to catch? As I said earlier, if you fall further behind, and even with a country like the U.S., could easily fall so far behind that there is no way to catch up. That may seem like something that's totally unreasonable, given what the U.S. is all about, and it's always going to matter, and it's always going to be a significant player, et cetera. But the pace at which China is pursuing change and growth and everything that it's doing is so mind-boggling that I'm envisioning that by 2030, they're in the lead and they're probably going to stay that way.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about some of the things that China's doing? For example, this Skynet thing that they have, and what that is, and why something like that, for instance, is so revolutionary.
So I think we should first of all clarify that a lot of the rules of the road that apply in so many other parts of the world, the West and, quote, democracies, et cetera, they just don't apply in China. And so you've got a population which has been made largely docile by a state which sort of molds and controls and does what it wants and takes what it wants from its people. And as a result of that, you've got a compliant population which is basically numb to the idea that anything the state does is something they can object to. Mm-hmm. So what the Chinese government is in the process of creating is this sort of all-encompassing state which probes every component of their citizens' lives and determines whether they're a good actor or a bad actor and whether they should be rewarded or whether they should be penalized. And they're doing this through AI means, which goes into every crevice of a person's life. That kind of thing would not be tolerated in the West to the extent that citizens knew about it. And of course, we've learned in recent years that there's a lot that we in the West don't know that our governments are doing toward other people and toward us. But in China, it's a unique set of circumstances, and it gives them a real advantage, I would say, in terms of how they pursue this race. Because if you don't have a population that's saying, hey, there needs to be some rules of the road here, and what about me, and do ethics and governance, et cetera, you know, comport in this calculation, then is there anything to stop them? I don't think there is.
Yeah, there's another interesting component of this, now that we're talking about the citizen monitoring. if you look at the number of smart city projects that are happening right now, out of 1,000, the last time it was reported for the year, it is in the book, they actually have 500 out of 1,000. And obviously, there's going to be a lot of growth in China with cities. I mean, the main growth and urban growth is going to come from China, India, and Nigeria over the next 15 years or so. But what's interesting is that as they embed like the citizen monitoring into cities, it could become something they actually export to other countries, and that becomes extremely concerning, I think, to democracy in general, because it's not. You can say it's for law enforcement and this sort of thing, but it could become intoxicating to the people in power. I mean, if you have that sort of AI that can monitor expressions, where you're going, tracking what you're doing, as costs come down to collect this data, I mean, that's sort of a scary, very dystopian future if not only in China this is happening, but people can get lured in other countries and say, hey, I want that. And then will China build in a backdoor to not only monitor their citizens, but other countries' citizens? That's a bit of a scary thought.
It's interesting. I recently watched an episode of Black Mirror, which I just love. Very entertaining, very realistic. And in this particular episode, it was where everyone has already sort of drunk the Kool-Aid and agreed that they're going to have to play this game. And they're being rated by everybody else on how much they smile and how well they reacted, et cetera. And if you have that docile population which is willing to play that game, there really seems to me that there is no limit to what the powers that be, whether it's, you know, the Googles of the world or the governments, et cetera, what they can do. We're at a pivotal period right here, it seems to us, in the sense that, as Keith alluded earlier, if we don't attribute some rules of the road to how this is unleashed from here, we really do possibly face a really dystopian future, which should concern everyone.
We talked about this earlier, and maybe now it's a good time to maybe delve into some of those rules of the road that you mentioned there, Daniel. What are some of the things around which you would like the major powers in the world to collaborate around?
Well, a good starting point would be to create an international organization which is devoted to creating rules related to governance and ethics and the law. I mean, the law itself is so far behind in this arena that there is no way to even imagine how you would determine what is a prosecutable offense and, where the line is going to be drawn in that regard. So if we haven't gotten to the stage where we've even acknowledged that there is a need to form an organization to create some of these rules of the road, and the same applies again in cyber. The parallels between AI and cyber are really interesting. And as you know, there's a chapter addressing that in the book as well. I don't know where we go. It seems like there aren't too many states that are interested in having that discussion at this point. They all seem too preoccupied, and organizations as well, too preoccupied with just elbowing their way into the race and trying to get to the front of the race to worry too much about what those rules are. And this is a really big concern because if we fail at this task, I think there just is no limit to the dangers that we're possibly going to be wading into in the future at multiple levels.
Yeah. And there's other interesting risks that pop up. If you remember that book that came out, The Anarchist Cookbook, which was written in the 60s, it was a guy, he was sort of part of the counterculture and this sort of thing. But if you look at the advances in medicine and AI and computing, I mean, we could come to a time where it's not only the state actors, which is going to be a problem. You know, what are the rules of the road for, the kid that writes this virus but doesn't release it, but he stores it somewhere. Then someone else downloads it and releases it. And then we could have similar, very destructive developments happening where people are kind of cutting and splicing these you know, viruses and making these custom things where, you know, you could, you know, unleash an epidemic. I mean, it seems a little dramatic, but it's almost like AI is going to contribute to that, because the more you can, you know, process information about genetics and this sort of thing, and it's going to become more accessible to the average person. How do we stop that sort of information from getting out, or can we, or, you know, detect it and that sort of thing? So these are some interesting things, you know, brings a whole new light to the idea of a lone wolf attack.
Right. You talk about that with regard to things like the Internet of Things and how everything will be, all these devices will be connected, et cetera, that, and you do that, Daniel, in your previous book on virtual terror. When you marry these two things up, as you said, it can be quite frightening, because what is the term for malware that, you know, AI based malware that you talk about? So malware that learns, not a pretty thought.
Well, unfortunately, these topics don't lend themselves to visions of puppy dogs and rainbows. We have to be realistic about this. I think it would be doing a great disservice to the people who are interested in reading the book to paint a picture that basically says, you know, the sky's the limit and there's nothing that can go wrong and we're pursuing our destiny and it's only going to be positive. I mean, everyone's going to understand that that's not realistic. At the end of the day, though, given the parallels between the cyber arena and the AI arena that we're in now, and the fact that we're basically in a similar boat with cyber, you know, we need a global organization to govern cyber. We need to find some way to counter so many of the things that are going on. We're going to get to that stage with AI. And the question is when. I'm presuming that we're going to reach a sort of a point of no return as soon as the next decade. I don't know what you think about that, Keith.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think the pace is going so fast, and I think one of the problems is there's economic interest at stake. Where, you know, you see the president of France, right? He's devoting, you know, 150 billion euros, whatever it is, to become a global leader in AI over the next decade as well. So, and then you have Germany and the UK also competing. So when you have economic interests at stake, what's also happening is that there can be a reconfiguration of companies, right? So when the future of the country or the largest companies are, you know, vulnerable, let's say, then, you know, how do you get to the table with other countries, and they could be the ones that could, you know, kind of take you out, so to speak, in terms of market share or whatever it is. And I think this is a problem. There's a lot of conflicting interests, and how do you find a common ground where you see for the good for everyone? So
you talk in your chapter, and I'm just, my risk manager's brain is working slightly overdrive perhaps, but you talk in your chapter on manufacturing and jobs about the truck driver who loses his job, and, you know, that potentially universal basic income and just giving that person money isn't really going to solve the problem of what does this person do with his or her life. And then, Keith, as you're talking about non-state actors and similarly about malware and that sort of thing, you can see scenarios where different groups rally around specific causes and create, you know, sources of chaos within our interconnected world through, you know, through some of these AI type of technologies. You know, what do we do? What do people do with all this sort of spare time on their hands? And some may not use that time in the most productive way.
It's clearly an opportunity for retraining, as one would think, obviously. But then that implies that companies and governments are going to step up to the plate. And what we've seen is that resource allocation in so many arenas is not what it should be. They need to get their hands around how they're going to allocate resources going forward, not just for that truck driver, but for society at large, because we're talking about a paradigm shift. And the paradigm shift requires advanced planning. But we sometimes find ourselves thinking that this advanced planning, either it doesn't exist or we don't know about it. But again, it's that curve that we're in search of. How far do we fall behind the curve as governments and organizations before it gets to the point where you just have to throw up your hands and say, what do we do next? Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things? I mean, some of the other thoughts that came out. You thinking about individuals and whether or not we'll get more. There's a question I think you asked somewhere. Will we get more stupid? will we have the ability to to control our own consciousness or communicate with our own minds? Because a lot of the solutions I think will lie within us individually, and then collectively. We need to be thinking about these things. We need to think more critically. We need to have deeper conversations with one another. We need to engage in critical thinking, creativity, all of those types of things to, to be able to make some of those connections and guard against some of the things that you're talking about. Do you have any thoughts on how with a lot of our maybe lower, well, I don't know if it's lower level decisions, but a lot of stuff getting outsourced to AI in terms of decisions that we might have to make. What do we do with all of this time we have on our hands? Are we going to have, are people going to engage with sex with robots, or are we going to engage in higher enlightenment type of activities?
Yeah, well, this is a very interesting question. I mean, if you think about humans biologically, and then you could make the argument that we're sort of like we're creatures that want to conserve energy, so why expend energy if we don't have to? Mm-hmm. And I mean, you see, again, I'm gonna use this word, like glimpses of it, but even with like cell phones, I think we might have talked about this last time we spoke, Ben, yes. About the idea of, you don't know, people's cell phone numbers anymore, because, why even know it? Because it's stored in your phone.
Right.
And similarly, even with the internet, why read history? Because it's on the internet. Well, what use is it? But it's that hard work that's going to give you the perspective. So when you look around, you actually have a unique view on the world. But that takes work, and convincing people to do hard work is could be a problem. I mean, that could be like a big cultural shift. Like, what's the use of it? So, I think absolutely this could make us, a lot dumber, in some ways, and it raises other, issues as well in terms of. What are we going to learn in school? Like, what's the point of even going to school if everything can really be solved by an AI in the future? So I think it goes to the core of our values. And there's one other example that I forget his name, but it's in the book. There's the champion of Jeopardy. He basically tells the story of a little girl that's on the beach and she sees some bubbling in Thailand. And she goes to her mom and dad. She says, "Oh, mom and dad, you know, a tsunami's coming. My teacher told me about it." And then they paused for a second. They said, "You know what? She might be right." And they left. And then she was right. The tide pulled back. The tsunami came in minutes later. So I think his point there was, because he was the guy that was beaten by an AI and he was the world champion in Jeopardy. So what is the point of knowing anything? But there is a point in knowing things, because it could be a matter of life and death. I mean, you don't want to take your phone and point at the ocean. It's like, what is this mean, right? And have an AI tell you when it's life or death situation. So that's just an interesting example I ran across.
Yeah, on the subject, since you touched on it, Ben, about having sex with robots, there is a term for that. It's called digisexuality. there are some people who actually prefer this, and it's the answer actually to a lot of people's issues in that regard, not only regarding sex, but regarding loneliness.
Right.
Think of all the single men in Japan, for example, who are just desperately lonely. They have chosen the company of robots, or think about the brothels that are proliferating in Europe that are actually run by robots, and of course where patrons have sex with robots. Part of it is a curiosity, part of it is need-based, and it is fascinating that robots and AI can satisfy some of the most basic, carnal, primal needs of individuals in our global society. It's fascinating.
It is.
Yeah. Just a quick follow-up to his comment. You know, what is interesting, though, there's a theme in the book that I touched on, this whole idea of complexity. So it's like, in one way, yes, we satisfy our urges, but what's the consequence of it? Like, could you have people that are just very, you know, are there going to be kid robots that come up and then, you know, people start having, you know, sex with these kid robots, and which is obviously extremely immoral, but would that actually prevent child molestation?
Right.
Or would actually increase the risk of it, because you have perpetrators and apparently they do brain scans of people, and it's actual a chemical imbalance that, you know, people find children attractive, which is scary, but it is a problem that we have to deal with as society. So, but we don't really know the impact of introducing these robots, adult-like, child-like, whatever it is. How is that going to affect real people? So that's a very, you know, concerning thing that could develop. We don't really know where it's going to go.
Yeah, so I think the unknowns are fascinating. But just getting these questions on the table is a very good first step. Sorry, Daniel, were you about to say something?
No. I mean, we could opine about these matters for hours, but I think these examples, they really serve to illustrate that there is so much that has not even been contemplated now about the potential impacts of AI on so many levels with individuals, businesses, governments, and societies. And anyone who has the answers, who says that they have all the answers, they just don't. Nobody does. The most that any of us can do, I think, is to, you know, throw some existing wisdom and existing experience at what looks like the pathway of the future and see if it makes sense to us. But we're in such uncharted territory that we may not know, is digisexuality going to become the new normal? Mm-hmm. Are people who are already so bored with their partners that they actually are looking at their phones while they're having sex, or they prefer to be on their phones rather than have sex? I mean, you see the impact that smart technology is already having on people on such an individual level. I mean, imagine if you throw AI in the mix.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so much that we don't know, and as you say, I think this, what's useful about all of this is just, at least we're having this conversation about it. At least you've written this book about it, but it also strikes me that if you think about the global international operating system in terms of the United Nations, the Universal Declaration for Human Rights, the Bretton Woods systems, all of those things were actually conceived in the early 20th century and applied after the Second World War. Similarly, with most legal frameworks that exist in most countries, they're decades behind what we might need to govern ourselves around this sort of stuff.
That's absolutely right. Right. And if we haven't gotten to the stage where we can update the UN Charter, or we can create international organizations that better reflect the balance of power and the strength of given economies in the developing world, if we can't bring ourselves to do something as basic and commonsensical as that, what hope do we have of leaping ahead and creating the types of organizations that are being suggested in this book? I'm not very optimistic in that regard.
Or even domestic law. So if there's a misdiagnosis created by an AI algorithm for something that's, you know, that's medical, and, you know, where does the liability sit? Can you sue AI for getting something wrong? What happens?
Well, of course, it's going to make mistakes along the way. Yes. I think any lawyer in the field would probably tell you that it's going to face a similar challenge as we do in the cyber arena in terms of attributing liability. A lot of these things are not being tackled for the simple reason that nobody wants to assume liability and nobody can attribute liability, because at the end of the day, if that AI makes a mistake, is it the fault of the software manufacturer or of the company that is rolling it out or of the user misusing it somehow? Nobody wants to tackle it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I got this from Daniel's book on virtual terror, but I think something that you allude to is that if you don't have, some type of teeth to enforce software companies to do more, let's say, quality assurance, make sure that the product is more viable, they're going to take the shortest path, which obviously is going to cost less, and it could have negative ramifications to the user.
Mm-hmm. The other, one of these things, so many things that we can talk at length about, but one of the ones that, that I found interesting was this thing called Avatar, this automated virtual agent for truth in assessments in real time, that supposedly, I guess, detects deception these are for border agents. Is that right?
Yeah, they were piloting a program. It was an academic program. I forget what college created, but basically, yeah, the Border Patrol were using it to assess people for, for risk, lying, right. Sort of thing. So,
lying to authorities and this sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense in a way, because if you ever, I guess agents or law enforcement, they're looking for, especially in airports or border crossings or whatever, they're looking for people who are suspicious, maybe appear nervous, might be lying, because maybe they're transporting drugs or doing something wrong. They have an arrest warrant. So they're constantly, using their own senses to assess someone. But when you get down to the level of AI and you actually see what some of these systems can do in terms of like looking at facial expression, micro expressions, eye movements, doesn't mean that it's perfect all the time, but it's sort of an extension of something that they already do, right? So why would they not use a tool like this? It seems logical.
And I think where that's powerful, if it's used in conjunction with human judgment, as opposed to deferring to that tool. I see this in...
Yeah, I think... Yeah, it's sort of the way it was described, at least, it's used in the sense of putting someone under human evaluation. I mean, sometimes you'll have people walking through and they'll grab someone to say, all right, okay, we want to speak to you. But what it will do is it's not going to like scan someone's face and say, okay, you have to leave. It will put them in front of a human investigator. Right. So, I mean, you constantly see this with AI and machine learning. You have a limited amount of work you can do as your workforce. So what do? You use an AI to help predict where is the most value of going to come from for putting my human workers. Mm-hmm. And this is where AI comes in. It tells them where to look.
Yeah. I see this, similarly with in sometimes in my day job, sometimes in related areas, but the use of models and financial models or investment decision models, and those are useful as decision support tools, but they shouldn't be making the decision for people. And I guess the concern I'd have for something like that is that if those types of tools become the used to make decisions as opposed to support them.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And it's complex. Like facial recognition, someone's face is not going to change. That's one problem, right? Because you're solving sort of a matching problem. When you think about markets and models and trying to evaluate, the risk, it's a very dynamic problem. Models have biases. They have their own risks. They don't capture their an abstraction of reality, really a simplification. And then even like similarly, like people's emotional state, trying to assess that, there's arguments that their emotional state is not necessarily linked to what they're thinking. So there's definitely limitations here. So you're absolutely right. We need to be careful how it's used and implemented. It's not written in stone.
Right. Yeah, one of my previous guests worked in security, and he moved to working in security in a university setting, and the same sort of facial features of students that were nervous about exams would be the same as those that that might be doing something untoward. So it's an interesting observation that you make there.
Well, as time goes on, the type of subtlety that's needed to distinguish between the two you just referenced is going to become prominent. And it will get to such a stage where mind reading may also be something that is contemplated. It will no longer be the realm of science fiction. And the AI will know so much about people and individual that they will be able to say, based on what they've done in the past and based on this facial recognition and based on X and Y, we will be in predictive policing.
Right.
Minority Report will no longer be the realm of science fiction. It will be right on our doorstep. And there are police forces already in the world that are using predictive technology, and it's working.
Yeah. This makes me think of, Ben, do you ever see that movie Conspiracy Theory?
Sure.
There's a part where they go into the apartment. I think it's Julia Roberts and I forget the main character. But he's a very paranoid type. He's got like tinfoil all over the place. And, he's locking his refrigerator and all his food. And, maybe that's a bit much, but it's sort of like, if you think about it, if we get to a point at some generation where they could read your thoughts, and this is already, again, in a clinical setting, they've shown some progress. That is really a scary thought, because then, you're going to almost control yourself of what you think, or, would we start walking around with tinfoil hats or something like that? I mean, that's sort of a strange thought.
Yeah. There'll be apps or online courses or things that you can take to disguise or disguise your thoughts or something like that, or send out the opposite thought of what you really intend to do and all of this stuff. it boggles the mind to think about all of it. I'm conscious of the time, but I would like to, perhaps as we try to wrap up, is perhaps, apart from reading your book, AI Supremacy, what are some things that you think we can do just as individuals, just to better understand this world in which we're heading into?
Well, I would say this about so many subjects, but I think there's just a really significant level of ignorance among the general population about some of these cutting edge topics and some of the implications that everyone is going to be faced with. So I think, just recognition of what some of these issues are is half the battle. But if we can't translate that into action on the part of government, then I'm not sure how much any of it is going to matter. What is it going to take, for example, to get the attention of the U.S. government so that it starts to devote significantly greater resources outside the military arena to tackling this? It becomes a national security issue. It's sort of like, the Bush administration 15 years ago recognized that the AIDS crisis was a national security issue, and that's when the billions of dollars got thrown at it, and that's when progress started to be made. What is it going to take for this or successive U.S. governments to realize the same thing? And by the same token, I mean, we list in the book how little so many countries that matter in the world are spending on the race for AI supremacy. I mean, Australia, not to pick on Australia, because I love Australia, but they've only just started to think about this stuff, and they've thrown, $1 million or $2 million at it over the successive years.
Wow.
And many, many countries don't even have or just recently got some sort of a policy on AI going forward, and are only starting to throw some money at it. I mean, I don't know why that could possibly be the case. Why would they think that this doesn't matter in this day and age? And it's not even just an allocation of resources issue, because it wouldn't take that much money to even make a difference. You're starting from zero. You may not go to 60 in 5 seconds flat, but it wouldn't take that much to get, you know, to move the needle above zero. My hope is that a lot of governments around the world are going to start to throw real money at this thing so that this can be a meaningful race and that it will have beneficial results at the end of the day. I'm just not convinced that that's how it's all going to play out.
Sure. Apart from China, which governments are perhaps throwing a disproportionate amount into AI?
Well, one that really stands out is South Korea, actually. To my knowledge, I think they may be in second place. I forget the exact figure, but it's tens of billions of dollars that they're throwing at it. And then that raises the whole question also about economic competition in the AI arena, which we touch on, and how, you know, economic competitiveness may ultimately become an issue of who has the better AI to throw at an economic competition problem. You know, what will make you more competitive as a nation, not only as a company? To the extent that China is making its companies national champions in this arena, they're going to have a huge advantage. In the U.S., in our country, we're too busy competing among one another to imagine that companies might collaborate meaningfully or that the government might encourage collaboration among companies that actually has a national benefit. China's onto something here. We may not like their tactics, but the way they're going to win the race, in some respects, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So, Ben, I would just say or add to that. To me, I think this is going to become a very political issue because, or maybe the political issue of the 21st century. I mean, there hasn't been a place that I've looked at, I think Daniel as well, where we don't see AI somehow having an impact. And the thing is, it's powerful. You know, the technology is powerful. You know, we have the storage, we have the devices. There's a lot of impact that can happen. So in my mind, I think people need to be aware of it and get involved more and, you know, talk to our local politicians what they have to do and, you know, find positive outcomes of where you can, you know, have AI. Maybe it's for their kids in the classroom. You know, how are they going to use AI? Ask the school. What are they investing in? You know, get involved in terms of, you know, your company. Well, what are the security practices? Try to make some noise again to your local congressman. Make sure that this is becoming an agenda. But it's really, if people anywhere you can see a problem or something that can benefit you, if there's a way you could get to decision makers to find positive outcomes to use AI, I think it'd be a good thing. And then hopefully that would sort of a bottom-up approach, get to the right people in leadership, right? And then they see that a comprehensive plan is needed. Because ultimately, again, I come back to this idea that kind of struck me for a long time of complexity, right? This is complicated. It's not like a linear thing. You're going to have AI that's developing, continue to develop. It impacts the economies. Then it's going to impact social infrastructure. Education, what do we need to teach? How are governments going to be support their people? What about retraining? This is all complicated. And the ironic thing is that AI, as much as it is going to cause the problems, it's part of the solution. So we need to find ways to deploy it, but within boundaries, how are we going to manage that so it doesn't become out of control? So it's a really interesting time in history, and I hope there's a way we're not so distracted that we can participate in you know, a healthy future for all of humanity, because, you know, there's a lot of problems in the world today.
That's really well put, and that is, I think, our challenge, not just, you know, across the pond over there. I'm certainly over here, we're very divided in the UK over Brexit. It's the topic, and other things don't get discussed, like AI, for example, or, you know, any number of other critical things, but certainly this one, I don't think I've seen much of a headline around AI over here at all, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of the major broadsheets. for instance. I mean, we're not talking about this. So,
That's a big part of the reason why we wrote the book, actually, is that we think that this certainly deserves to be on the front pages and not just as some interesting article for some techie to absorb. It should become part of the normal dialectic in government and business. And, you know, some people get it and a lot of others just don't.
Well, this is... sorry to interrupt, but one of the things I really like about this book is that it isn't for the techies. And the problem with all of this stuff is that people assume, well, it's just some smart techies working on this. that goes for everything, you know, just about everything that is a big technology. Just show me what it can do, but I'm not really interested in the implications. I'm more interested in when the next iPhone comes out or whatever, as opposed to thinking about some of these broader questions. And you position this very well in a language that people can understand, and I think is very valuable as a result.
Well, we appreciate that. And Ben, I think you put your finger on it. This book is not for the techies. There's plenty of material out there that they can consume and that they've written. This is for the other 99%. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why we didn't hesitate as non-practitioners to dive into these topics, because we presume it's going to resonate with a lot of different types of people.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing is, if you think about, the leaders in AI research, I think some of them are, thinking about these topics, but I think it was a very honest attempt to take a really comprehensive look at the issues. And I don't think that, from what I've seen in the literature, that anything like this book has been produced to address it in that way or in that thinking. Because, a lot of the time, not all of the AI research, but a lot of people in AI research that really understand it deeply, they don't look at these issues. Well, what they're really interested in is solving a hard problem. This is why you have PhDs that go into finance and write these crazy algorithms, but it doesn't have any meaning to their life. And some of them have realized that and walked away. But what are they really driven by? They're driven by, they want to solve really complex problems. But the complex problem we're trying to solve is not writing code. It's, how should our world be structured, and what is the future going to look like? So
it's a great book. And I think that, I urge every one of my listeners to read it. And hopefully it, makes some noise, because we do need some noise in this space. I'd like to wrap it up fairly soon, but was there anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to mention?
I think we had a pretty broad discussion, Ben, as usual. And thank you for having us on. And thank you also for taking the time to read the book. And not everybody that we speak with has actually taken the time to do that. So it really made a difference in the nature of your questions.
No, it's my pleasure. Keith, was there anything from your end that you wanted to mention before we wrap things up?
No, that was it. Again, Ben, thanks for having me on and reading the book. I really appreciate it as well. I mean, I found your questions to be very pointed, and I think you really got to the heart of some of the issues. So I appreciate you taking the time to do that.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. This is an absolute pleasure, and this is why I do this as a labor of love, and it absolutely is. Before we go, for people who are interested in the book, where can they get a copy?
So this is published through Amazon, this is the second time that I've published a book on Amazon. I had a really great experience the first time with Virtual Terror. So that's where it is. It's out in paperback and Kindle, and in a short time it'll be out in the audio version as well.
Perfect. All right.
Right. And one other thing, Ben, if your listeners ever want to get updates, they can always go to the website, AI-supremacy.com. Articles there and things like that, so they might find updates, so they could learn more about us. So just so you know.
Wonderful. And all that will be in the show notes. Thank you both for joining me. This was great. Very interesting. And wish you all the best with the book. And let's hope that more of us start getting into the conversation about AI.
Cheers. Thanks, Ben.
Bye for now. All right. I hope you got a lot out of that and that you enjoyed the conversation. Check out the book AI Supremacy, Winning in the Era of Machine Learning for more. It's out now. Links are in the show notes. You can also go to ai-supremacy.com where you can get the book. And let me know what you think of this episode. You can drop us a note on Facebook or Twitter. You can subscribe to All Things Risk. Simply go to allthingsrisk.co.uk. That's .co.uk. We are also just about everywhere you can find podcasts. So you can find us on your favorite podcast app and subscribe. We will be back in 2 weeks. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.